stories of Tinseltown. We got a new song, and yes we do. So come on days, and come on months, and all you others too. Listen to the stories of Tinseltown. They're not only good, they're true. True stories of Tinseltown. Ooh, ooh.
Hey everybody, and welcome to another True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have one of your favorite authors on, and one of mine, Robert Mattson. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Grace. It's nice to be with you again.
I know. Numero tres is a charm. Three times is a charm. And wow. I really enjoyed your other shows, and I know people listened and enjoyed them a lot. Robert was on before. The first book I had him on for was Fireball, and it was based basically, you know, she was working for World War II, selling the war bonds, and Carol Lombard, amazing book. And then the next one was Dutch Girl, about Audrey Hepburn and being a young girl during World War II and, you know, the aftermath. And also today we are talking about Mission, Jimmy Stewart, and the fight for Europe. And I'll tell you, you know, I loved all of your books. Like, I tell you, they're so heart-wrenching, but so well-written. And, you know, you can't candy coat war. You shouldn't candy coat it. Right?
No. What that brings to mind is that there were two F-bombs dropped in Mission. Because when you're in a B-24 Liberator at 20,000 feet and the Germans are shooting at you, you know, you might have a tendency to drop an F-bomb. And so when the manuscript in galley form went out for review, one copy went to this retailer, this Christian retailer.
Oh, no.
who went back to the publisher and said, well, we can't sell this book with that vulgar language in it. And they wanted the publisher to censor those words. And they came to me and I said, forget it. And then they backed me up. And so I don't even know why I tell you that. But I always thought it was kind of funny.
Candy, you know, coating that, it. That's why you told me.
Candy, that's whatever. That's right.
Yeah,
that's
like
right.
They're you know, being shot at from all angles. And they're going, oh, golly, stop it. Darn it. You know,
yeah.
You're in a fight for your life, man. Anyway,
right.
We will start. This is James Stewart. And why don't you tell us where he's from? And he did have a military background, so perhaps that pushed him a little bit to be more gung-ho.
Yeah, so he's from a little town. It's a small town. It's not a village. It's a small town called Indiana, Pennsylvania, which is very close to where I grew up. Indiana, PA is a college town, and I grew up in a college town in southwestern Pennsylvania. So I really understood the vibe of Jimmy Stewart as like a small town boy. And both of his grandfathers served in the Civil War. And one actually became a general in the Civil War and was one of the heroes of Gettysburg. And the other one, his other grandfather, served under General Custer, for crying out loud, in the Shenandoah Valley. So there was already a proud military tradition by the end of the Civil War in his family, the Stewart family, and the Jackson family. That was his mother's side.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim's father served in the Great War, which would become known as World War I. So all Jim's life, from birth, he knew he was going to have to serve in the military. It was the proudest thing you could do as a Stewart. And so he was on that track from his earliest days. His mother would make him army uniforms to match father's uniforms. And, yeah, I mean, you know,
that's kind of cute, though, but yuck. Terrible about the war business, but it is kind of cute. Because, of course, kids want a copy and they admire and, you know, respect, and they're kind of heroes. So it was cute. She did
sure.
That.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so his father went off to war. Jim was, 9
Yikes.
Years old when when his dad went off to serve in Europe in the Low Countries. And his father didn't see direct action, as in shooting guys, but he was close to the front lines. He was an ordnance officer dealing with artillery. So, and so he came back with, you know, a ton of war accoutrements captured from the Germans. And that's what Jim would play with, you know, as a kid. He would play with German helmets and German weapons. So, yeah, I mean, like, he was a warrior from the earliest days.
Do you think his whole personality, as you say throughout the book, he's very introspective. And he, no matter what he ate throughout his life, he couldn't gain weight because he was so, he had so much nervous energy, right?
Yeah, and that was the morphology of his family. But he in particular was a string bean, you know. I mean, the very definition of a string bean.
Oh, was man.
Very grew up to be 6'3" and a half, but never topped 160 pounds.
Wow.
His whole life, no matter what he did. When he hit 160, that was at MGM after the bodybuilder got a hold of him and told him to drink, you know, milkshakes and put eggs in it and do all these things, eat your steak and all of these the doorbell's ringing.
Avon.
Do all the things to gain weight and lift weights and all these things. But really nothing worked. And when he did that stuff, when he went to that extreme of eating all these things, it just upset his stomach. So he was trapped in that body and very, very self-conscious of it, which is how he ended up being a playboy in Hollywood, which just, it, you know, trying to overcome in his own mind the fact that he was unattractive.
Well, he went to Princeton. His father owned a hardware store, right? That was like the family business. And so...
Family business and the center of the town, you know. He was like the town character.
The daddy-o?
Yeah.
Well, do you know what he did when he made... what one is that? Anatomy of a Murder. The father took out an ad in the paper and told people not to watch it because it was obscene. His own father.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. His father did have a big problem with that picture in particular, yeah.
Okay, so let's get onward and upward. So he hit Broadway. He befriended, he became lifelong friends with Henry Fonda in New York. Is that where he met Margaret Sullivan as well?
They actually met before New York, before Broadway. They were all in, like, summer stock on Cape Cod together. And yeah, they all met there, became very fast friends. There were others, too, that names that, you know, that were names you would have known 50 years ago, but you really don't know them now.
And then don't really remember the whole group.
Well, Mildred Natwick, you know, was another one. And, Charles Drake, I think, you know, actors that were from the 40s, 50s, 60s. Anyway, they all made it to Broadway sort of in a pack and started getting parts there. And then one by one, they got, it was like, you know, talent scouts from Hollywood would snap them up and sign them because motion pictures were just exploding and needed talent, 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 just like, you know, big league baseball.
Right.
Went after the talent. And so Fonda got picked, Sullivan got picked, and then finally Jim got picked by MGM, which was the luckiest break of all because Fonda was selected by Fox, which was good, but MGM was the best.
Of course, that was like the premier kind of, all the studios, that was a premier. What was it, Paramount, yeah. Fox, and MGM? And the other ones, they had like poverty
Warner
real
Brothers.
Places. Yeah.
Well, Warner Brothers and Universal and Columbia, but really, really, MGM was the top of the line. You know, they had five studio lots in Culver City, five or seven. They were just huge. It was the biggest industry. They had their own railroad yard to, you know, to ship film out and ship set designs in. So, I mean, like, yeah, it was the best.
And so they moved there. And they become roommates there as well.
Yeah. So Fonda welcomed Jim at the Pasadena train
How
station.
Cute.
And, yeah. Yeah. And yeah, they set up shop in Brentwood, California.
And they had a couple others, but I want to make this one thing that kind of irked me. A book came out, I believe it was about Henry Fonda, and they bring up the fact that they were roommates in New York and in California, and bringing up like, you know, like a gay thing about them, which I find really, you know, come on. Just because you know how expensive New York is, it was for them, you know, it's expensive for these guys. They're not making a lot of money. And Jimmy's new there. Do you know what I mean? That kind of bugs me. If they did, they did. But I don't know how you put, okay, so they were roommates with other people and they were best friends and you automatically make that they were gay together. They
you know, it's funny, though. Hmm? What's funny is that Louis B. Mayer is the one who cast that aspersion. You know, he said, well, we can't have one of our players like living with another guy. That's not right. So that's how far back that line of thinking goes.
Well,
you know,
it's
ridiculous, but.
But think about Cary Grant and Randolph Scott.
I was just gonna say that.
They did all these. I mean, I didn't see any husband and wife photo shoots like they did of Randolph Scott and Cary Grant. These were just like, you know, Cary's wearing the apron. I mean, these are just such things. You know what I mean? And this is 1931, 32. So I guess times have changed. But they published these young bachelors, you know, when they're living on their own and whatever. And to think that I didn't know that. They made them move apart. When did Henry marry Margaret Sullivan, who James had a life? Well, he loved his wife, but he had a huge crush on Margaret Sullivan.
Oh, no. He was in love with Margaret Sullivan. His wife didn't come along till long after the war, Jim. So I think it was 36 that Fonda married Margaret Sullivan. And it didn't last long. I think by 37, they were quits. But there was some talk that Jim and Margaret Sullivan had a physical relationship too, which wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, because he was so crazy about her.
Yeah.
And she knew it. She knew he adored her. Yeah. I think Walter Pidgeon made a comment once how she would, you know, kind of wrap him around her finger and she knew it and she liked it or whatever. I think he once made a comment about that.
She was a Southern Belle, very, very Scarlett O'Hara.
But she had that husky voice. And, I heard that people, they fought a lot, Henry Fonda, and she had a temper. So I heard people heard them yelling up and down the street. So they weren't shocked when they got divorced. But James became sort of a little playboy about town, which I never knew. I mean, he allegedly, which they said is not true, I think in your books too, lost his virginity to Ginger Rogers. I've read that too. But I don't think that's true. And he dated Norma Shearer. He dated Marlene Dietrich, whom he impregnated. And these are not women you would think, like Marlene Dietrich, Norma Shearer, you know, these kind of vixen-y, vampy chicks. You wouldn't think that he would be dating them, but he did.
Yeah, he was known as a good lover, you know. There were euphemisms for it, but yeah, he was very talented.
Go, Jimmy, and, go, with all those 135 pounds, you know, 6'4".
Yeah, the aw shucks, boy next door kind of a thing. All these women wanted to mother him. Norma Shearer in particular was an intense one. And it was, I think it's fascinating that it was the basis for the Norma Desmond character and the William Holden character.
No, I never heard that.
Boulevard. Oh, yeah. That the aging diva of the studio, Norma Shearer, newly widowed after Thalberg's death, latched onto Jim and gave him a gold cigarette case that had Crazy About the Boy.
Really?
Engraved
wow.
On it.
Big scoops. I never heard that.
Oh, yeah. And that's where the screenwriter, whose name I forget, the screenwriter for Sunset Boulevard was working at MGM when that scandalous affair between Shearer and Stewart was taking place. And he recorded all that and
How cool.
turned it into Yeah, turn it into part of the plot of Sunset
Mad
Boulevard.
About the boy. Wow. Who knew? Yep. Yes, and someone said, didn't Norma get asked to play the part, I believe?
She may have been. She may have been asked.
But you know, she would never have done it. Anyway, he, you know, obviously because she liked Jimmy Stewart, Marlene Dietrich, if you've ever read her daughter's book, which is amazing, Maria, she discusses her mother getting pregnant with Jimmy Stewart. But the mother liked him a lot. And she, you know, certainly if he wasn't Mr. – if he was just there for, you know, shaking hands and slobbering over, she wouldn't have liked that. So obviously he had something going on, little something, something. And then he hooked up with Olivia de Havilland.
Yes, and that one was completely different because, you know, the other women that he had, Loretta Young was another one, and as you mentioned, Ginger, they were pretty fast women, you know, experienced.
And Lana Olivia as was, well, didn't he kind of say she was a hot number?
Oh, yeah. And there was talk of Harlow, too. I mean, whoever was anybody, he went after the A-list, I'm telling you. And it wasn't like he was a shark or something. It was just he needed to prove he was attractive. It was the biggest thing in his life before the war.
I thought he was cute. I thought he had a nice face. I didn't think, you know.
Yeah, but not in his own head. Not to himself.
He wasn't dreamy. You know, it's like I look at some of the other ones. You know, they're more dreamboaty, but he's very cute. Are you there?
Yeah, sure. But Olivia was different. You know, she was a very serious, another loner like he was, kind of tended toward depression like he did sometimes. And they formed a pretty tight bond, but they had slightly different career aspirations, and he knew he was going to go into the service, and that pretty much killed it.
Right. So Pearl, he knew how to fly. He took flying lessons before the war. He knew if he was ever anything, he was going to be a pilot.
Right.
So
right. He had become enamored of flying from the age of 12 and went up the first time with a barnstorming pilot after the Great War. And that was it. You know, I mean, like he knew that flying was in his future. And the first thing he did with the money he got from his MGM paychecks was to take flying lessons and then buy a plane.
Oh, I didn't know he had his own plane. I'm sure I read it because I read your book twice because I read it a long time ago and I just reread it. And I don't know. My mind is just, oh, well. But that's something. He must have had his own plane. All these people had their own planes if they flew. Anyway, so he goes along in Hollywood. He gets the Philadelphia Story and he gets the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. Right?
No, wait. So he builds his way up to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Oh, yes.
Should have won the Oscar for that. Did not. So the next year, they gave him the Best Actor Oscar for the Philadelphia Story.
Oh, he was Best Actor.
You're right. It was Best Actor. He should have been Best Supporting Actor because really it was Cary Grant's picture.
Right.
But Stewart got the consolation prize for Mr. Smith by winning Best Actor for Philadelphia Story.
He did a good job. I liked the Philadelphia Story, but Mr. Smith was something, and he was great in that. They always do that. Like, they didn't give to Joan Fontaine. She should have won the Academy Award for Rebecca, but she gets it the next year for Suspicion. And Suspicion's a good movie, but Rebecca, she was great. Just far
perfect
superior.
Example. Exactly yeah. The same thing. Yeah.
So he worked his way up into that. And when did he start the war? It was Pearl Harbor. Boom. Now we're in the war.
And now we're in the war, but Jim was already in the military for 9 months when Pearl Harbor happened.
Really?
Yeah, Jim went in. He was actually drafted in the fall of 1940.
Uh-huh.
So then he went and reported for his physical, and he was turned down. He was declared 4F because he was so tall and so thin. He did not make the chart. And boy, did that piss him off. And boy, did that piss his father off. His father was furious because he thought Jim was dodging service.
Oh, no.
Because he he read a headline in the New York Times or someplace that said, you know, Stewart deferred, and he got on the phone and he reamed out his son, even though he didn't even give Jim time to say, oh, you know, I'm really upset about this. He just let him have it. Jim went back to his draft board, to the doctor who had given him his physical, and said, had a very frank discussion, and that's when it was a good thing to be a movie star, because you had a lot of pull. And he sat down with the doctor and said, look, I'm never going to gain an ounce. I've tried. Professionals have tried to get weight on me, and they can't do it. And if you go ahead and defer me, you are going to lose yourself one hell of a pilot. That's what he told him. And so right there in his personnel record, which one of the first things I saw when I did the project, is this letter from this doctor that says, I affirm, in my professional opinion, this man has a family history of being very thin, but he's healthy otherwise, and I recommend him for service. And that letter stayed with Jim through his career and got him into the military when everyone else was trying to stay out, because this was before Pearl Harbor.
Right.
So when Pearl Harbor happened, Jim was already at Moffett Field in Northern California near San Francisco, and he was, you know, flying every day. And he would win his wings 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor and become a second lieutenant in the Air Corps.
Didn't they have to do, like, all different kind of flying and learn all this different stuff? Did he learn it there, or did...
No. He had his pilot's license before the war started. Before he went into service, he had his pilot's license on a single engine, and he got his commercial grade license on a twin engine right after he went in. So, I mean, like, he was set up on two engines when he was made second lieutenant. And so he was so far ahead of the game of all these pilots that would come in after Pearl Harbor. He was suddenly a flight instructor, because he was so experienced and so much older, had a good head on his shoulder. He became a flight instructor for all of these pilots that were coming into the service.
How old was he at that time, Robert?
When Pearl Harbor happened, he was 33.
And the average pilot around him was around 22, right? 23, 24?
20, 21, 22,
babies.
Yeah.
Oh, my word, yes.
Yep.
So
this was a significant factor, the fact that he was 6'3" and a half, and it meant he was not eligible to fly fighters. So that was one thing. The other reason he wasn't eligible to fly fighters was because he was so old. You know, relatively speaking, when you're 32, 33, 34, you don't have the reaction time you have when you're 20, 21, and 22. So they couldn't put him in fighters for those two reasons. So he became an instructor on bombers. He became a specialist, an expert in bomber control, four-engine bombers, where there was more room in the cockpit and where a good head on your shoulders was, like, super important.
And that was the B-54s? What am I doing?
Oh, that's... You're so funny. The B-24. There were the two heavy bombers.
I was close.
You were. You were. Just three numbers off. There were the B-24s and the B-17s. The B-17 was the glamour, you know, airship, the flying fortress. And that was the first four-engine plane that he was certified on.
Uh-huh.
So he was training pilots in how to fly B-17s. But when it came time for him to go into action, which is a long, complicated story that took chapters in the book, as you know.
Yes.
He went into a bomb group that was B-24s, which was like the very, very ugly stepsister of the B-17. You know,
That's
it was
terrible.
The plane nobody wanted to be in, because it was a big, ugly, horrible-looking bomber, not a sexy thing like the B-17, but that's where they needed pilots, and that was what was going to get him to Europe. And so that's what he was like, full fine. I don't care what the plane looks like, as long as it flies.
Is that when he went to Iowa?
That's when he went to Sioux City, because he had been kicking around all these different air bases training
right
different pilots And so, yeah, so he went to Sioux City, met the 445th Bomb Group, was going to be its operations officer, which was a really nice role. But within a couple of weeks, they saw what a superior leader and flyer he was, and they made him a squadron commander. So he had 15 planes, 15 crews, 15 ground crews under his command. All of a sudden, he was a captain at that time.
So how many people would that be? How many are in a squadron?
Well, 15 planes. Each was 10
wow.
specialists on each plane. So right there is 150.
Wow.
And then each ground crew is another 10. So it's like 300 men.
Oh, that's pretty good. And I wonder, just by him coming in, if people thought he would be a prima donna or something because he was from Hollywood. And they saw that he was not. You know, that he took this seriously and he wasn't, you know, looking for special favors or anything like that.
Quite the opposite. He was a by-the-book officer, and he did not want, he did not want any publicity. He did not want to be treated like a movie star. Well, this is on the one hand, but there's a catch. He wanted to be an officer in the United States Army and do his duty for his country. It was his speech that he always said when he was in front of a camera.
Right.
But the tricky thing is that he was not afraid to pull rank. You know, from the time he went in and asked the commanding officer, he could get an audience as a private with the commanding officer at Moffett Field and say, you know, I don't want to go make movies at Dayton, which is what they wanted to do originally with him. He had the pull to go in and ask a general or a colonel to do things for him. And he kept doing that throughout his service. When he got to England, he was still sort of, you know, like playing the game and, you know, playing movie star for the officers and stuff. But that's the only time he did it. You know, he was not a prima donna at all, but he would use his influence to help himself, which is natural. Why
which
not?
Is natural. And it's funny that more people use their influence to stay out of the war. And he's using his influence to make sure that he can be a part of it, which is amazing.
Make sure he can get shot at.
Right?
Yes.
Oh my God. Yeah. So, did he ever, because he was, how long was he in Iowa? I mean, because he was there for war and he must have been antsy to get over to Europe in a lot of respects.
No. See, the thing is, when he got to Sioux City, it was like August. It was August 1943. And they were only there for 3 months before they went. And every day they were training. And their training was taking planes up, flying in formation, doing simulated bomb runs, dropping bombs in fields,
right,
and then flying back. They did night flying. He almost died in a night flying accident on a training mission.
Mm-hmm.
He crash landed some planes. I mean, like, this was really rough, and a lot of crews died, you know, in training because the machines, they were just inventing heavy bombers at that time,
right.
You know, so there were lots of malfunctions. So, yeah, those 3 months, he wasn't really itching to get over there because they were working their asses off.
Just to learn every aspect of the machine.
Yeah.
But how can you really, until you really get over there and you're living it, man. But it's good that they got the more experience. But when you get there, it's like, yikes.
Plus, it proved his superior command abilities because his squadron was a really tight squadron. And all through the war, through the 20 missions that he flew, you know, he gained a reputation as, oh, well, Stuart's in the lead. I think we're going to do well today. You know, that's what the generals would say. Oh, Stuart's in command. Well, that's a good thing. And he had a really good record, relatively speaking, which is not to say that lots of planes weren't shot out of his formations, because they were, because the Germans were really good.
Well, I guess they practiced a lot. They were ready to take over the world for a lot of years. So I don't know. Anyway, so he finally, they get the call. They go to Europe. And this is in 1943 they go to Europe?
Mm-hmm. He lands on Thanksgiving Day in this muddy little place called Tibbenham, England. in East Anglia, where all the bomber bases, were in a certain part of England, and all the fighter bases were in a different part of England, because the fighters were doing one thing, the bombers were doing another thing. So they kept them grouped, and so Stuart was over here. You can't see, but I'm pointing. He was over here near Norwich in the eastern tip of England.
Yes. And that's, and it was not like a really glamorous base. It's a joint. I don't think it was even prepared. They weren't the first ones to go there, right?
Well, they weren't the first bomb group, certainly. They were in the second wave. After the first wave of bomb groups had been blown out of the sky, they needed a second wave of bomb groups and planes and men. And Jim was in the second wave, but the base that he went to was brand new. It wasn't even actually done yet when they set up shop there in this little village, which still has one church, you know, no stoplights. it's just there are two taverns, one church, and some houses with thatched roofs. And, you know, that was where he was stationed with his group, in the middle of nowhere in England.
And they, to get to these things, the pilots and the guys that are on these crews, the conditions of them flying when they went up was unbelievable. Freezing, so much happened. So when was James' first flight? And he was the co-pilot, right?
He was always co-pilot, and that was because he was the quarterback of the formation. And you had your hands full flying the plane if you were the pilot. You couldn't have been the pilot and the leader of the formation because you were too busy being the pilot.
Right.
But as co-pilot, you know, he was quarterbacking the missions from the right seat, yeah, facing these horrible conditions. He flew his first mission on December 13th, 1943. See, I wrote this book years ago, but there are certain things that you remember. Like he landed on Thanksgiving and they trained and trained and trained in England. Then he flew his first mission on December 13th. It was the first mission for the whole bomb group. And he was on it. And that was to the very northern tip of Germany. They bombed some submarine pens. And it was a very successful first mission. His first few missions were very successful, meaning they didn't have any planes shot out of the sky.
Yeah, that was something. So they must have started feeling pretty good about that. And then how many times? Was it 30 times that a pilot can fly? And if he survives, then he's done. You can't fly anymore after 30 times. Or was it 20 or 25? I thought it was 30.
It was all of those. It was all the above.
Depending on the person?
Because they – no. It was the crew. The bomb crew – after 25 missions, they would be routed home. But then there was such attrition. They lost so many planes, so many guys, that they made it 30 missions. Then they made it 35 missions.
Wow.
That you had to fly before you came home. And that's the whole story of the Memphis Belle, was they were on their 25th mission, then they were going to get to go home, and were they going to make it? And when they did make it, then they toured the United States as this wildly successful crew, you know, and these heroes, because they had made 25 missions. It was really hard.
I can't imagine. You guys, this book is amazing, and I love all of Robert's books. And one thing I say to Robert is, his writing puts you right there. And he also includes different people. He includes his kid, Clem, who's very young, and he's coming into the group, and a German soldier even, and different. And we meet all these different guys, and we get to know them. And then you see, you know, you're reading what they go through up there. And tell us when he first lost Cruz. When did that happen? Do you know? How many flights in?
Zero. You know, it's crazy. So they have to go from the United States to England. They have to fly their planes to England. You don't think about the fact that, well, the plane's got to get there.
Yeah.
Not only the men have to get there, but the planes have to
over
get there.
Over the Atlantic.
So they have to fly
that's
them.
A long
flight.
So
exactly.
They, yeah.
So they flew from Florida down to Puerto Rico, and then down to South America, the eastern coast of South America, then across, they crossed over at the shortest point to Africa, and then they went back north. So when they were off Puerto Rico, one of his planes went down behind him in formation, crashed into the ocean. It was Lieutenant Poor, P-O-O-R, was the first pilot who died, and his whole crew was lost at sea.
Ten.
And it just affected Jim immediately. I mean, like,
how
oh, my God.
Not?
You know, we're not even there.
Yeah.
We're not, you know, we don't even need anybody shooting at us. Our planes are falling out of the sky. And it hit him hard, and it was the first letter home. The first set of letters home was to the crew of Albert Poor's bomber.
So he had the job of writing the letters? When the people were either killed or were missing in action, or they parachuted,
right, yeah, yep, that was his job. All the commanding officers took that job very seriously, and he was no exception.
Yeah. So, but he had his first two or three flights out of there. He lost no crew members when they were actually flying.
And then. It started, and then they had what they called milk runs, which was, you know, they would hop across from England, and they would bomb a target on the coast of France, and then they would go back, you know, and that would be the mission.
Right.
It would take 3 or 4 hours instead of flying into Germany, where it's a 6 or 8 or 9 hour mission. So the first few were pretty painless, and then you get into flights into Germany to bomb German targets, and that's when you face the fighters and the flak, and that's when he started to lose planes, and that's when his own plane started to get hit.
Yeah, he had a really close call, but the pilot didn't get away, but most of his crew was parachuting down, and it's just really, ugh. And even the way they describe this, and this must be unbelievable, is that they get blown, literally blown out of the sky, and one of their friends' heads hits their plane. And it's like, oh, my God. I mean, they're dealing with their friend's body parts, and yet trying to stay alive and trying to stay the course. And it's good reading, because like I said, the F-bomb, you don't need the F-bomb, because this is real, and he doesn't sugarcoat, which is what I like very much about your writing. It's really, like I said, I feel it, and I feel for these people, and I get to know them, and you know, they come back from these missions, and people look at them, and they're like, oh my God, you know, they're just wrung out, they're in, you know, after they lose how many crew members, how many friends, little by little, you know, or lots by lots.
And they're young, but they're still young, and they're kids. And one of my favorite chapters in the book is where they're at the base between missions, and they're kids, and they're trading comic books, and they're playing ball in the hangar.
Oh, God. You know? They are kids. They're kids.
They're 20 years old.
It's just amazing to me. And there was no age limit. You could be a 20-year-old pilot, or did you have to be like 22? I know the other old guy was 27. They called him the oldster. He was 27.
Yeah, and, yeah, yeah. But no, there were pilots as young as 19, I believe.
Oh,
I know that it might have been one of the pilots that he lost. Oh, now I forget his name. Boy, that bothers me because I love those guys.
Me too.
I wanted to honor those guys, you know, the guys in the bomb group who were the pilots. They were heroes. They were so cool.
They were amazing.
But his youngest pilot in his squadron went down. And that's hard, you know, a 20-year-old kid.
Wasn't he the one who had just gotten married and his wife was pregnant? And well, they had a lot of stories like that, which was just that you have to write it and write to the parents, write to the wife, write to these people. And you know these people, and it must be so surreal. You're up there. It's freezing cold. Some of the guys at first thought they could bring their comic books on the plane, and they realized they were not going to be able to read their comic books because it's freezing. You get into these situations, and then there's malfunctioning. you know, an engine goes out, yeah. a bomb won't go. It's amazing, amazing.
Well, in a way, the B-24 was a death trap because it had this fuel leak problem, and it would just tend to sort of blow up in the sky, which is why it's really good to be, you know, have your crew be 20 years old because you're invincible. You know, you don't think it's going to happen to you. So you just take this thing up every day and take your chances.
They must think it's going to happen to them when it happens to their friends so often. How do you, but you have to keep, you know, your game on because you don't want to be the person who dies the next day. I just can't even fathom. I cannot. So why don't you tell us about, it was the big week, which was really a horror show for them and for James.
So they decided, the bomber command of the 8th Air Force decided they were going to concentrate on knocking out the German ability to make aircraft, because they had to command the skies before they could launch D-Day. They had to knock out German aviation before they could land troops, you know, take 5,000 vessels across the English Channel. So they set up all these targets. They needed 1 week of clear weather, and they found it in February 1944. And they just sent wave after wave of planes from England to bomb German aircraft manufacturing sites. And that was called Big Week Operation Argument. And Jim participated in the first mission of Big Week. He was scheduled to go on another one, but it got called off. And then he was not flying the mission to Gotha, Germany, that just decimated the bomb group because the Germans sent up like 250 fighters or something, and all of this very deadly flak, and 13 of the 25 planes from Jim's bomb group were shot down that day.
Oh, my God.
That was the day when body parts were hitting windscreens.
Oh,
and
God.
It was just it was hell on earth, and he had to take the next mission back to Gotha because the job wasn't done. They didn't knock the target out. So the next day, he had to lead that mission, and that was the hardest mission that he flew. His plane got hit right at the cockpit, and it blew a hole between his feet. And so he had to fly for like 5 hours.
And they could literally look down through that hole. Correct.
Yeah, his briefcase was blown out through the hole and his parachute. So he had to fly the mission without a parachute, knowing that if he didn't make it back, that he wasn't going to make it back.
Right.
I mean, there was nothing, you know. So after that mission, he did make it back. The plane cracked in two on landing. And he cracked up. I mean, it was too much. It was the strain of command and the physical strain of that particular mission was just too much for him. And so he had to be sent away, as most pilots did sooner or later. They had to be sent away and put on sodium pentothal, or sodium amytal, I think they call it, which just calms you down and makes you relax. And it sort of erases a lot of the bad memories.
Oh, how horrible for those men. Well, you must have seen the best years of our lives, right?
Sure.
And Fred Derry, the first thing we see is him having a horrible dream. He's a pilot, and all his crew is going down, and it's burning. And you know, I can't even fathom. I mean, you get so close to these people. They become... So where did they send them to London?
No, not London. They sent them north, away from the bomb groups and the bases. They sent them north to, like, the country, you know, to a nice country estate where they turned it into a hospital. And you know, if you just decompress for a week or two, and they sort of reprogrammed you. They had psychiatrists there who, when you were under the drug, you could be reprogrammed to happier memories.
Sort of like a hypnosis kind of deal.
Yeah. And then they would pronounce you fit and you'd be sent back. And so he went back and he flew a few more missions, including one to Berlin. And then it happened again. And after that, he didn't fly as much for the whole rest of the war, just because he was worn out.
I don't know how anyone can do more than three missions. I know they have to, but, you know, oh my God, and how anyone survived that. It's amazing. And so when Normandy came, I don't believe, did he fly?
No.
No.
He wasn't flying. In the run-up to D-Day, which is another of my very favorite chapters, oh, my God, I give myself goosebumps just reading that and thinking about it.
Amazing.
So he was on the ground prepping crews to fly tactical missions, hopping across the channel to hit German targets and hit them in places that were obscure enough that the Germans couldn't figure out where the attack was going to come from. So that's what he was doing. And it was really important work.
And that's like, didn't they hit a lot of fuel places where the planes fueled up? Because if they couldn't get their fuel, then they couldn't get their planes up in the air.
It was all kinds of tactical targets. It was marshaling yards, you know, like railroad yards.
Yes.
And bridges and troop barracks and like you say, you know, fuel dumps, things like that, that they were hitting. Anything to interrupt the German response to the attack that was coming at Normandy.
It's just like unbelievable. And you see this, you know, like when I watch a war movie, which I can't very often. And it's, you know, the ones in the 40s and 50s were very good, and 60s. And I cry like a baby. And people say, well, it's only a movie. And I'm like, you know, this happened. There was D-Day and people died. Many, many people died in the Battle of the Bulge. You know, this happened. And I don't get how people can just not feel that. You know, I guess they're lucky in some ways that they don't really have that kind of empathy or can put themselves in that situation or know or feel that. But, you know, these are real true guys and it's happened. Yeah, these are actors, and they didn't die, but you think about all the ones that did, and it's holy heartbreak.
Yeah, so, it's a great point.
So during that, he's sort of mapping things out, and where is he? He's not any longer at that place, is he?
He's not in Tibbenham. He's in Old Buckenham, which is another little village that's five or six miles away. I visited both places.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, they're charming, just very remote places. And so that was the 453rd Bomb Group where he stayed for about almost less than a year.
He didn't fly there, did he?
He flew a few missions, yeah, he did. And they were not particularly successful missions because this was after his second crack up and he was really suffering PTSD and burnout. There's a before and after picture in the book of him in 1942 when he won his wings and he looked like the young, you know, handsome kid, Jimmy Stewart.
Right.
And then him just 2 years later when he looks like maybe Jimmy Stewart's father.
Right.
Because he just looks terrible. His hair is falling out and the skin's hanging off of him because, you know, that's what 12 missions did, and that's what he had flown at that point, 12 or 14 missions. And there were still six or eight more to go.
Oh, boy.
So when he made it back to Hollywood after the war, he was really worried that he couldn't play leading men anymore. He was just too old. He's just too old looking and too feeble. And that's why his phone really didn't ring at all, because, yes, he's a war hero. He's back. He's back in Hollywood. Yay. But he didn't look like anyone you'd hire.
Right. He was in shock. They said Clark Gable, he did a whole different mission than James Stewart. And he aged tremendously. But I think that was also put on top of the fact that Carol died, that his wife died. And so he aged a lot, but Jimmy, you look at him. And that's when his hair started falling out, huh?
Yeah, when he, the only call that he got was for It's a Wonderful Life from Capra.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to make it at first because he he wanted to just do a comedy, and he thought this thing about suicide and angels was too bizarre for him. But then he reconsidered when nobody else called, and he took the part. My point being that it was the first time that he had to have a hairpiece, and he was made up within an inch of his life to look much younger than he was.
Yeah, he was supposed to be just a kid, yeah.
Yeah, he started out, and he's supposed to be, 20 or whatever at the beginning of the picture, right. Or is it even younger?
In the beginning, he has this cute little kid who gets slapped in the ear by, that's how he loses his ears, by the pharmacist, Mr. Gower, keeps slapping the poor kid in his ear.
It's an interesting point, is that when he gets slapped in the ear in the picture, it's mirroring what happened to Jim in the war, because he had lost a lot of his hearing because of the engines from all the planes that he took up, the 9 hours on these, you have no idea how loud a single engine plane is if you're flying with an engine like 6 feet from you. Well, there were four engines just a few feet from you on these 9 hour missions, and they are so loud, even with headsets, you are deafened. And he spent the rest of his life with diminished hearing, and it got so bad that he had to read lips to know his cues.
Wow.
On these pictures.
Yeah. But you know what? I think some of the best acting work he ever did was in It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, the tortured man, you know, not knowing what he's going to do, yelling at the kids, throwing things around. And that bar scene, oh my God. His acting is amazing in this film.
And it's on the edge, because he admitted to having lost his instincts. You know, he had been away for 5 years, and he had lost his confidence, and so he was just winging it. And Capper had to coach him all the way, and so his performance has such an edge because he was on edge.
Yes,
he was so desperate, and it shows in the performance. And I think it's part of the brilliance of the performance, is that it's not a Hollywood actor's mannered performance.
No,
like you would see
it's wonderful.
Before. This was it's a whole different animal.
You
that this
feel
guy
it.
Is.
You feel it all the way in his whole life. The disappointments, you know, his brother, Mr. And the irony that his brother becomes a big war hero, and George can't go because Mr. Gower slapped his ears up when he was a kid. So he was 4F'd. Is that what they call it?
4F. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was the leader of the air raid squad and things like that. He did things to support the war, but that's also ironic. And it's just, to me, a great performance. And I think, did he get his confidence back after that? Do you think after doing that film? Or
he did,
half of it?
And he realized that he could harness the rage and anger and sadness that he felt inside of him from the war. And he really transmuted that into performances in Winchester 73, The Naked Spur, Vertigo, you know, a lot of these pictures. Shenandoah, when he slaps the kid who shoots his son, you know, just moments of rage. And,
yeah.
And they mirrored what Gloria, his wife, said, that, and his daughter told me that Jim had just sort of these violent outbursts out of nowhere, you know, and it was because of the war, and it kept up for, you know, decades, just because that's what you're left with. That's the scar tissue inside your brain.
How can you ever? I can't imagine. I really can't.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine seeing one dead body of a friend or something like that happening. I just, Jesus, I couldn't do it. And all these things these guys saw, and how they even came back to be able to function, amazes me. Because this is really, you know, like we were saying, war ain't pretty. And war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. And that's the truth. But, you know, a lot of his performances were deeper. Obviously, he couldn't do Sweetie Pooh Pooh Boy Next Door performances as he was getting older as well. But, I mean, how dark was he in Vertigo? How dark was he in other kind of films? So he did explode at home, huh?
Yeah.
Every once in a while.
And it wasn't that he was a toxic person. It was just
he had
you know,
to, yeah.
Just that it, Yeah, he had to let off steam sometimes, and his family understood that.
You know,
I admire so much. I went into this not a big Jimmy Stewart fan,
right?
But I came out of it just with so much respect for not even so much the 20 missions. That's too awesome to really, you know, calculate.
Oh, man.
But what he overcame when he came home was just terrific. You know, he really was a hero. I don't like his politics, boy, but he was a hero.
And what about, like, so many did not go. You know what always got me was this John Wayne hero stuff. And people, he's number one, you know. Even, you know, when I was really young, I remember that he was even, like, voted one in the top 100s. He had been dead, but he was voted one of the top 100s. And people thought he was a hero because he did all those films. But he did not have to go to war. And people didn't know that. And he was all for the Vietnam War, you know, pro-war, this, that. But he didn't have to go.
So, no, and I always thought it was interesting that Jim and John Wayne could be as good of friends as they were. And they were good friends. So Jim didn't hold it against John Wayne that he didn't go. But I do.
I do, too, because I just don't like that he, you know, people mistakenly felt he went because of all these films and Mr. Tough Guy. Now, he's not a tough guy. They say he wore 3-inch lifts and he had a rug, you know, and he didn't do that. But, you know, whatever. You know, he took it. A lot of people don't want to go to war, and I don't blame them because, you know what, I wouldn't either. But, you know, what bugs me specifically about him is that people actually think he did go to war and think he was a hero. So that's what bugs me about him more than anything. Anyway, so he married Gloria. We kind of missed this. He didn't want to marry an actress. Correct?
No, because he didn't think that he could take an actress home to Indiana, PA, and stand her up in front of his parents. And he was right, you know. So, but his choice was a divorcee.
With two children.
And his father never accepted that fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
And she didn't go to church. And she told him that. Yeah.
Yeah, and she smoked cigarettes, oh my God.
Yeah, but they were happy for years. They were together for years, and then he had twin daughters with her. Did he didn't adopt the sons. I think they had their own father that they saw. But, yeah, that must have been something for his parents. But he had a happy marriage with her, from all accounts. And
very, very happy, yes.
And then when she died, he just failed. He didn't care anymore. You know, he's just like, I'm going to meet Gloria. You know, I don't want to be here anymore. And he died at 89. And what I love about your book, you do so much. You and your wife went to all these places. You met Clem. You spoke to a lot of the people who worked with him. All the people we get to know in the book, you can still hear from, the ones who lived. And their stories and what happened. Not all died. Clem was shot down, but he lived. And he had, I mean, it's just a wonderful book. All I can tell you, Robert, you know that. You know I love your writing and you know I love your books. And like you said, you know, you get chills thinking about that chapter. I get chills reading it. And, you know, I'm feeling and I'm going, and I'm like, it's making me crazy. And so, you know, what, I got to put on an I Love Lucy or something. Not be in this dark place, but amazing. And I admire him so much more. You know, I always thought he was a decent human being, you know, but when I read this book, I really liked him even more and admired him a lot. And I also, what was it like? And you flew in the Memphis Belle, right?
Yes.
What was that like?
It's like being in the back of a tractor trailer going down the highway at 80 miles an hour. You know, it's a bucket of bolts. And
how far did you guys fly?
It was just like a half hour flight. I did a couple of times.
Did you have a parachute on?
No parachute. I flew in the cockpit and then flew through the rest of the ship and went down into the bomb bay, and I went forward. And you just have to do that because how can you write about what they're going through
if
you don't have any concept?
Was one of the ships, one of the planes. It was the plane that James Stewart was in and commanded these guys in. Is that what it was?
No, no, no. It was just another, a different. Okay, so the Memphis Belle is a B-17. So I flew in a B-17. I also flew in a B-24. And they aren't planes that were actually flown by anybody in the book, but they are vintage World War II
right.
bombers. So
very cool. You did a lot of research, and you went to these towns. You wrote, or you talked on the phone. You met Clem, and they gave you sort of you got a lot of words for them, and they were all respectful of James and admired him. Correct?
Oh yeah, definitely. They thought he was a superior pilot and leader, and a really good guy.
He was.
You have to separate out some of the mythology that happens, you know, about Jimmy Stewart from the real Jim Stewart, the man and the flyer. You know, it wasn't all jolly times, and Jim didn't really stutter when he talked to his men. But you have to weed out all that stuff that happens over the decades, because these guys tell these stories over and over, and they get adapted into what people want to hear.
Yeah.
They want to hear that Jim Stewart was a bumpkin, you know, and but he wasn't. You know?
He was a very sophisticated man. For goodness sakes, he made Marlene Dietrich pregnant. How sophisticated can you
be? You're really impressed by that one.
Well, no, because I talked to her grandson, Peter Riva, who is wonderful. He's Maria's cool. son, and he knew, I think Marlene was about 30. He was 37 when she died, so he really knew her as well. He was a wonderful mm-hmm. guest. And so, you know, just in that, I'm like, I heard that rumor, but it was a true rumor that she did get pregnant and had an abortion with him. So, that I just couldn't see, you know what I mean? She wouldn't be with some bumpkin. You know, she wouldn't be.
Oh, right. That's exactly right.
No.
She did not suffer fools.
And why would people think he was a bumpkin? Oh, because he'd go, shucks, or every once in a while? I don't know. You don't go to war and remain a bumpkin or ever be a bumpkin when you're training and doing all these things. I don't get it.
Oh, and Dietrich was paired up with Eric Remarque, who wrote, you know, he was a terrific author and a very sophisticated guy. So,
First one incredible war movie, Sound, All Quiet on the Western Front. What a film that I can't watch again. It's devastating to me. What a film.
Right.
And it politically, and then showing everybody in the trenches and, you know, hey, it's Christmas, so war stops, you know, I'm not going to kill you today. Let's play ball. And it's just an amazing, yeah, she did. But like I said, I got to know him and like him so much better. I cannot recommend this book highly enough, as I do all of his books, Fireball, about Carol Lombard, Dutch Girl, and Mission. I mean, these are great books. So, Robert, it is such a pleasure to talk to you again. And thank you for writing all these fabulous books. I know you have another on the way, and I hope you come on again when that comes on out.
Well, you say such nice things. How could I refuse?
That's right. How could you refuse? You better not. But what I say, you know it's sincere, because I tell you when we're not on the air, I tell you that. So thank you so much. You guys will love this book. You will have a newfound respect. And you just read some of the reviews he's gotten on the book, because they are amazing. It's called Mission, Jimmy Stewart, and the Fight for Europe. And it is amazing. And he was amazing. And you are amazing, Robert. So thank you so much for coming on again. And everybody, be safe. Take care. Until next time. Bye, Robert. Bye, everybody.